You are listening to the Confronting Christianity podcast, and I am here with a fellow Brit. Love talking with fellow Brits, Justin Brierley. Hi, Justin. How are you?
Hi, Rebecca. Yeah, very well, thank you. What a pleasure it is to join you on your podcast.
Remotely across the pond. For those who are not yet familiar with Justin's work, and you all should be, Justin's worked in radio, podcast and video for over 2 decades. Until April of last year, he was theology and apologetics editor for Premier Christian Radio. And he hosted the Unbelievable radio show and podcast, as well as the Ask NT Wright Anything podcast. For those who are not familiar with NT Wright, he's a very well-known New Testament scholar and very interesting guy. Justin currently co-hosts the Re-Enchanting podcast for Seen and Unseen. He's a guest presenter for the Maybe God podcast. So he knows much more about podcasts than I ever will. He's also recently launched the Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God podcast documentary series. And that is connected to your latest book, I believe, Justin, which is called The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God and was published in September of last year. So I'd love to talk with you more about that. But first, I want everyone to know where you live in England. Where do you live, Justin?
I won't give the exact street address, but I live in a commuter town called Woking, which is only 25 minutes by train from Waterloo, London. So it's wonderful for not having to live in London, but being very much in striking distance of London.
It's also just a wonderful name, Woking, because one of my favourite English words, funnily enough, is the word onomatopoeic, which for those less nerdy on the English language side, means words that sound like what they are. And yes. I feel like Woking sounds like Woking. Am I right?
Well, I don't know. I mean, is Woking a very awake place or woke place? I don't know.
It's nothing to do with being woke, for those who are wondering, for better or for worse.
I mean, the irony is, if anything, Woking, given its next stop on, is where there was a large cemetery where all the bodies from London used to get put on a train and taken to Brookwood Cemetery.
Oh, wow.
It's more a place where people go to sleep than wake up.
So oh, but maybe know, where but they will one day be awoken if they have trusted
true,
in Jesus.
True,
oh,
indeed,
I love that.
Indeed,
okay.
Yes.
I'm thinking of woking in a whole new way now and not being judgy, as I grew up in sort of more central London. So
okay, yeah.
Look down my nose at Woking, maybe.
Well, absolutely.
Really.
It's suburban commutersville, as I say. It's got its own particular charms, Woking. Sadly, its main claim to fame at the moment in the UK is that the council recently went bankrupt,
which
is just ridiculous for a fairly affluent part of the country. But there you go.
Yeah, does seem like somebody did something rather wrong.
Yes. I won't go into the politics of it, right. But there's some fairly unpopular councillors currently.
Okay, I should think so. Well, we're not going to be spending our time today talking primarily about Woking, much as I'm sure that would please our listeners greatly. I wanted to chat with you, Justin, about perhaps an odd question for two people who are serious followers of Jesus to even ask. But I think it's a question that is being asked on both sides of the pond as well as in other parts of the world. And it's a question that in some ways Nietzsche touched on a couple of centuries ago and prodded us as to the implications of the answer to this question. And that's the question, is God dead? So Justin, you have just written a book about the surprising rebirth of belief in God, suggesting that maybe once upon a time, not too long ago, more and more people were saying, do you know what, we actually don't even need to consider belief in God. Like the idea of serious belief in a real creator God is sort of passé, obsolete, no longer something that people can actually, like, at least seriously educated people can hold on to. But you've been noticing in your time in the last couple of decades of talking with atheists and agnostics and people of all sorts of different backgrounds that actually The idea that God is dead, that we can kind of rule out belief in a creator God if we're proper educated modern Western folk, that's actually being questioned today. So tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, well, I think you're right. People have at various points over the ages kind of predicted the death of God, haven't they? And you had that Time magazine cover, I think, in the 1960s, when it felt like the whole of academia seemed to be turning in this very materialist direction, saying there's absolutely no evidence and so on. But yeah, the book is really about the fact that I think things tend to work in cycles, or tidal sort of metaphor is the one that I use in the book, that actually for every prediction of the death of God, you find that in an extraordinary way, God gets reborn, or the church that kind of proclaims God gets reborn in each generation. And I've noticed this just in my own sort of limited experience in the last 20 years or so, where the new atheism really was a very in vogue form of anti-God denialism. And that kind of had its heyday from sort of the mid 2000s to the 2010s, really. And the conversations I was hosting on the show I hosted, Unbelievable, were very much around that whole thing of these very distinctly anti-theistic voices critiquing God, saying we absolutely have no need for God anymore in a scientific, rational age.
The sort of Richard Dawkinses of the world.
Absolutely.
And his merry men. Yeah.
Indeed. The four horsemen, as they came to be called, they included Dawkins sort of as the scientist, but you had, you know, the rhetorician in Christopher Hitchens, and you had the kind of popular public thinker in Sam Harris, the philosopher in Daniel Dennett. So they each had their own best-selling anti-God book. And it did feel like, you know, this was just the cherry on top of a long period of secularization and de-Christianization of the West and so on. So you know, you could have been forgiven for saying, yeah, at that point, it feels like God is dead. But as I say, things the ground can shift quite quickly. And I began to notice it changing quite quickly, sort of in the mid-2010s to late-2010s. Suddenly, I was encountering a lot more people coming on the show who might call themselves atheist or secular, but who distinguish themselves from this new atheist brand you know, anti-God belief. And, you know, they wanted to sort of, even if they didn't agree, you know, describe themselves as Christians, they could at least acknowledge the value of Christianity. Mm. And I started bumping into more and more of these secular thinkers who were essentially saying, actually, we shouldn't just throw the baby out with the bathwater. And indeed, bumping into a surprising number of converts, adult converts, yeah, to Christianity as well. And that was sort of the basis, really, for me starting to question whether we might be starting to see the atmosphere change in a kind of unusual way.
Mm. What is your sense, Justin, of what has been driving that, if there is one thing or a couple of things?
I think there are a few different things. Firstly, it's just instructive to see the way that the new atheism itself as a movement kind of collapsed in on itself. And I spend the first chapter of the book kind of describing that in some detail, both, I think, because it didn't really answer ultimately people's existential questions. And just pointing people towards science and reason doesn't ultimately really help them, you know, make their way through life. Mm-hmm. But also because it kind of collapsed internally. They were just, once the kind of chief architects had agreed that God doesn't exist and religion is bad for you, I don't think they could actually agree on anything else. And so they just had very different visions for what should happen next. And some people wanted to go in the direction so-called atheism plus, which was atheism plus a commitment to, you know, LGBT rights, feminism, and so on. Others said, no, that's just politically correct ideology. You know, we don't want any of that. The whole movement basically was split asunder because of this. And the infighting within the movement was far worse than anything they ever, you know, had against Christians. So there was all of that happened. And it kind of was a demonstrative of the fact that there's kind of a religious instinct in us, even in an atheist kind of, you know, worldview. People are looking for something, and I realized that if it left anything behind, it was a kind of a meaning void, actually, was not being simply, you know, filled by some scientific rationalist utopia. Actually, quite the opposite. All kinds of interesting, weird, esoteric beliefs, you know, continue to be frequently what people came up with. You know, there's still a huge fascination with the occult in our culture. There's still lots of new age stuff hanging around. And I think certain types of, you know, political ideologies often fill that void. So whether it's on the progressive left, you know, people who find their identity in sexual and gender identity, and that kind of becomes their sacred thing, or on the right, you know, some kind of political mythology, the cult of Trump, whatever it might be. There's always, I think, things that people basically turn to in the absence of a story that makes sense of their life. And so I just was noticing that this, you can't kind of eradicate that kind of religious instinct in people. Yeah. And the question is, what story in the end are people going to kind of you know, focus their life upon. So for me, that bigger picture, I think, helps to explain why I think people are starting to turn back to taking the Christian story seriously again in a way that would have been actually almost unthinkable in the heyday of the new atheism, that so many people that I bump into now are kind of willing to talk in serious terms about Christianity, not just Christians, but secular people too.
Right, yeah, no, that's interesting. Yeah, I mean, so one of the things that I think you and I would both agree with Richard Dawkins on is that whether people believe in God or not is actually, to some extent, irrelevant to the question of whether God exists. You know, I think, you know, I would align myself with Dawkins in his sense that actually people, we humans are prone to believing all sorts of stupid things. I think probably you and I would apply that dictum more broadly than some of the new atheist folks would, to say actually sometimes people's dogged insistence on believing in atheism can be as foolish as anybody else's. But it was fascinating to me, even reading Dawkins. I reviewed his kind of book for teens that I think maybe came out in 2019, something like that, called Outgrowing God, A Beginner's Guide. And in that book, you know, you mentioned how Dawkins and others were portraying religious belief as just like bad for you and bad for society and bad, bad, bad in every way. In that book, even Dawkins has to acknowledge there's actually a ton of evidence that people who do believe in God behave more pro-socially than people who don't. Like that, it's actually, much as he squirms when he has to acknowledge this, people who are actively religious are happier, healthier, longer lived, more pro-social, kind, like all the things actually, like just on average, than people who aren't. So, and then he makes the interesting comment, you know, it would be kind of patronizing for us to say, well, we're much too clever to believe in God, but we think it's great if other people do. But actually, really, that's sort of where you're left as a, you know, as an atheist intellectual who sort of prides yourself on your pursuit of truth and data and like following the science, as it were. I think that's kind of where you get stuck, is to say, well, I really hope nobody else realizes that God doesn't exist, because actually we're all going to go to hell in a handcart, even if not literally, you know, that this is actually going to be really bad for society.
I think Dawkins almost just sees it as a rather unfortunate thing that we have to, some people seem to have something like religion to be able to lead meaningful, flourishing lives. Whereas, you know, some people are blessed with science alone and reason sort of being enough. I think what he doesn't acknowledge enough, though, is that as Tom Holland puts it, Dawkins is a very Christian atheist. You know, he is completely shaped by the Judeo-Christian heritage that he's adopted, even as an atheist. And so to that extent, none of us can escape the kind of framing at which our religious culture or the religious past has given us.
Yeah.
And so the very way in which Dawkins talks about and the things he values and everything else, it's even if he doesn't think he has, you know, he needs the benefits specifically of religious practice, he's still, you know, enjoying the benefits of the religious culture that has completely shaped the culture that he now finds himself an atheist in. So I just think there's, you know, there's all kinds of levels at which people are starting to acknowledge actually that this religious story has been quite important, not just in the immediate benefits it brings, but the fact that the outlook Richard Dawkins can have is kind of a downstream of, you know, the Christian revolution and so on.
Yeah, and actually the critiques of Christianity and the, you know, of both the Christian history and actually of the Bible in particular, you know, the Old Testament, the kinds of critiques that somebody like Richard Dawkins levels are critiques based on the idea that all human beings are fundamentally morally equal, that genocide is wrong, that the strong and rich and powerful shouldn't be attacking the weak and the poor and the marginalized, like all of these things, which, as you say, is sort of an inheritance of Christianity that people don't necessarily acknowledge.
I think, obviously people like the historian Tom Holland have brought this across very well in books like Dominion. And a recent edition of my podcast, you know, featured his story and, you know, the way that he has really been challenging his secular peers, people like Dawkins, on their essentially Christian humanist beliefs. But the most powerful part of that podcast actually wasn't from Tom Holland. I think it was an interview I did with a woman called Jenny, who comes from communist China originally. Yeah. and has only very recently essentially started to look at Christianity and in the recordings on the verge of embracing it. But she, her comment on Richard Dawkins was, when she started to investigate and listen to some of, you know, the debates on God and so on with Dawkins involved, she said, I wanted to shout at him, your version of atheism is not the same as my version of atheism in China. You would not be leveling these complaints against the God of the Old Testament if you came from where I came from. Because she said, it's just normal. That's the way it works with power in China. Mm. That's the way it is. You know, big people squash small people. That's normal. Your objections are specifically because you come from this Christian version of atheism. And I just found that fascinating, that someone like Jenny, kind of coming from the outside, just saw this huge difference in the way that Richard Dawkins carries his atheism. And it is a very Christian form of atheism in that
sense. And what's even more ironic there is that actually, I think it's fair to say that communism is in some sense a sort of attempt to deliver on Christian ethics without Christianity. You know, it's a sort of Marx disillusioned with the failures of the church around him as he saw it, and wanting at his best to create a world where there was genuine human equality and where it wasn't just a sort of, you know, rich versus poor sort of scenario, but failing to reckon with one of the realities of human nature, which is that we're actually all very sinful. And so if you try to create a system where everybody is equal, actually what you'll create is just what Jenny's describing there, a system where the powerful squash the disempowered. You know, that's kind of going to
It was so interesting to hear her perspective, because one of the things she said was, when I came over with a number of other, you know, Chinese expatriates and settled here, we were all asking ourselves, why does this country seem to grow quite nice people, you know, where they're charitable, they look out for each other, they have these humane, you know, there's at least not terribly visible corruption as we see in back at home and so on. And they just thought it was something in the water, until she said, the thing that was invisible to me was religion, because that just doesn't figure. And she realized, but she came to realize that it was this Judeo-Christian heritage. So it is fascinating. I think exactly like Tom Holland says, because it is the water we swim in, we don't see it. Someone perhaps coming from another culture suddenly thinks, yeah, why does everyone act and talk and this way? And it just suddenly brings you up short and you realize actually there is a good reason for this, you know?
Yeah. And funnily enough, I've had a conversation a few years ago with somebody who'd, you know, moved to the US from China and had become a Christian. And the way that he described it was like Christianity was delivering on the promises that I could visibly see that communism had failed to deliver on.
Right.
You know, it was like a longing in his heart had been created, even by the sort of the rhetoric and the propaganda that he was hearing in China, that then when he met Jesus, it was like, oh, this actually puts the heart into the body of what, you know, what I was raised to long for and thought that there was no possibility of.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Let's maybe then sort of drill into that, Justin, because, you know, one of the ironies from a Christian perspective of even asking the question, is God dead, is that we believe in this very weird story about the God of all the universe coming to live as a human being and to die, which I think, because it's so familiar in our culture, even, you know, for people who wouldn't identify as Christians at all, probably most people know that Christians claim that Jesus died on a cross and rose from the dead a couple of days later, like that this is normal for us just as an idea, even if we think it's ridiculous. We're sort of not taken aback by it, because we were raised kind of knowing that this was a claim out there. Ever since Jesus's female followers were the first to witness his resurrection, women have been sharing the message of Jesus with those who have never heard it. In his new book, 10 Women Who Changed the World, Seminary President Daniel L. Akin tells the stories of 10 women in particular who were called by God to serve as missionaries all across the world. As I've studied missions and read missionary biographies over my lifetime, Akin writes, I've been amazed and inspired by the large number of women who left home, families, comfort and safety in obedience to Jesus and his command to go to the nations with his gospel. Their number is far greater than most realize. You can find out about a handful of these stories in 10 Women Who Changed the World, which is available wherever books are sold. Help us understand, just, you know, from an original kind of first century perspective, like quite how weird this claim is, that the God we believe in actually came to Earth in order to die. What's even going on there?
Well, yeah, and I mean, I would defer to the greater knowledge of biblical scholars who spend their life in this, but what I have picked up along the way is just how weird this claim was that the first Christians made, that the king of the whole universe had chosen to descend, not just simply to become human, but to die the worst, most disreputable, scandalous kind of death you could, the kind of death that was reserved for criminals, rebels, slaves. But that's it. That, you know, one of the very earliest hymns we have in Philippians is precisely this. These are words that go back to the very first generation of Christians. And they said, you know, this was a God who, even though he was had equality with God, chose not to hold on to that, but chose to become nothing, taking the nature of a slave, not just a slave who died this worst of all deaths, even death on a cross, but willingly did it. And I mean, you talk to someone who knows about the gods that were, you know, the pantheon of Roman and Greek gods of the time. I mean, this was just anathema. You know, the gods might send someone down to do some bidding on earth, you know, but the idea that a god would get themselves crucified, I mean, that was the end of, you know, that was, as Nijay Gupta, who's got a great book out on this called Strange Religion, says, it's almost like you could roll a dice and just make up a religion, and you couldn't get something more bizarre than what the early Christians were claiming. And yet it's obviously become so much part of our cultural furniture, that the idea of the cross being actually a symbol of sacrifice and love, you lose sight of just how bizarre a claim that would be to the Romans, to the Greeks, to most of the world actually that has ever existed. And yeah, it is an extraordinary thing. And I think it's part of the job of, you know, Christians today is to try and re-engage that weirdness, because it becomes so second nature, you know. Sometimes it's helpful to actually remind ourselves of just how very, very strange though that belief was.
I was talking with a friend recently who's not a Christian, but is absolutely believes in God, believes there is a creator God, believes sort of to some extent, sort of some elements of what the Bible says and not others about who God is. And I was trying to articulate to her that I don't have a kind of store-bought definition of God. Like I don't have a conception of God that can be divorced from the person of Jesus Christ. And I'm curious if, as you've talked with, you know, many kind of atheists over the years and many, you know, probably many people who've left Christianity as well as people who've kind of come to Christianity by various means, have many of your conversations been about a sort of generic idea of, is there a creator God at all? Or has it tended to just end up being more rooted in like, okay, what is the specific claim that we're making about God here? Like the sort of specifically Christian claim about who God is as revealed in Jesus Christ.
I think it's easy. And a lot of the shows I have and conversations I have conducted have been at that more kind of purely abstract philosophical level, you know, is there scientific evidence for a creator behind the universe? Does this philosophical argument for the existence of God work? And that very much kind of might be useful if you're just trying to argue for the sort of God of the philosophers, you know, pure being or sort of a set of properties, you know, all loving, all good and so on. And there's a value to those debates and discussions. But I do agree with you that actually often that's at some remove from the God of Scripture and the God made known in Jesus Christ. Because if all someone was left with was a kind of intellectual assent to there being a sort of plausibility to the idea of some kind of divine mind behind the universe, well, that might be something, but it's certainly not enough as far as I'm concerned, because actually it's, you don't get, that's not the full picture. And likewise, you know, so often the debates I've hosted sometimes on the problem of suffering or evil, you know, again, they tend to get cast in quite intellectual philosophical terms. But again, for me, if you don't have the key component of the idea that God became human and suffered himself, and that for me is a game-changing part of the whole story. And so I would never be content if certainly a Christian sort of missed that, because for me, it's like, yeah, the problem of suffering is going to always be probably an almost unanswerable one in the absence of this Christian idea that God himself knows what it is to suffer.
Yeah.
And in some mysterious way has chosen to take upon himself all the sin and shame and suffering of the world. But it's kind of, as soon as you go into that, you lose that sort of very purely philosophical, logical, abstract kind of view of God. You're entering into sort of far more mysterious territory. Messy. But actually that's actually the territory most people actually live in most of the time. Few of us are just sort of logicians on legs, are we?
Yeah.
So I'm kind of quite happy in a sense for the philosophers to have those debates, but I'd rather actually get down to talking about Jesus at the end of the day. That's where I think where the rubber hits the road, you know?
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely true. For the first 9 years that I lived in the US, I worked for an organization called the Veritas Forum, where part of my role was sort of finding Christian professors at world-class universities, whether in the US or Europe or other parts of the world, you know, sort of tracking them down and then chatting with them, figuring out, like, hearing their faith story, thinking about how we might support them in actually talking more openly about their faith in the university setting. And one of the things that was really striking to me was how often, not always, but how often, when somebody's story was one of coming to faith actually as an adult or as a student, you know, kind of not having been raised in the faith, but actually coming to faith in Jesus kind of later on, how often there was an experience of suffering that actually prompted that. And I'm curious if that's something that you have observed as well in your conversations over the years.
I mean, absolutely, in the sense that I think there are lots of people who maybe kind of have an intellectual interest in the God question. But more than, most of the time, I found that it's actually in the process of experiencing real life and suffering and difficulty that actually it kind of becomes a real actual existential question. I mean, I can think of just one friend, Dean, who's works in intensive care as a nurse in Australia. And he's been fascinating to me as a friend, because he came along to the Unbelievable Show initially through Jordan Peterson. Jordan Peterson is one of these secular intellectuals I talk about in the book, who seems to be pointing people back in the direction of the Christian story in their search for meaning and purpose. And kind of Dean is one of those people. He kind of was into the new atheists, you know, in the mid 2000s. He read Sam Harris, Dawkins, and so on. But he didn't feel like they were giving him the full story. And his work in intensive care and all the, you know, the life and death stuff that involves, kind of really, he came across frequently people who either dealt with it really well, seemed to have resources, spiritual resources to deal with it, and people who didn't. And in his own life, he's experienced a certain measure of suffering and pain. And he's just came to realize that the answers of the new atheist didn't work at a deep level with the way he actually experienced life. It couldn't just be boiled down to sort of biological processes and evolutionary stories and things. He just really resonated with Jordan Peterson, taking his existential questions very seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And he's been on a really interesting journey, engaging with scripture, engaging with the Christian worldview. And I don't think he'd say he's there yet, but he suddenly found that actually it's precisely because of the journey he's been on, you know, trying to make sense of suffering and so on, that he finds that there's something very powerful in the Christian tradition that doesn't logically tick all the boxes, but kind of gives him a kind of a framework from which to just engage that, all the difficulty and hardship in the world. He just finds it a more fulfilling way of doing it than a kind of, well, basically the explanation that it's all ultimately meaningless, which is kind of the alternative on a kind of atheist worldview. However you dress it up, that's still what it boils down to. So I find people like him, it's usually you have to have a little bit of, often I find it's people who have got a bit of experience under their belt and might have certainly had a new atheist phase. I frequently find they're the ones who have eventually found, no, it didn't really do the job. And they're kind of coming back round to potentially exploring Christianity as a way of understanding things.
Yeah. I mean, I appreciate Richard Dawkins' sort of clarity on these things, like when he said in one of his earlier books, the universe as we observe it has precisely the properties we should expect if there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil and no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. That it's kind of like a, you know, I think his call is kind of open your eyes and see that that's the truth. You and I would probably say, open your eyes and see that that's the alternative, as it were, to belief in Jesus. What would you say to someone, Justin, and this is going to be the last question, of someone who thought, who said, look, I would love to believe in the God you believe in. You know, sounds great. I wish that I had that kind of faith. But I'm a highly educated person. You know, I may not go everywhere Richard Dawkins goes in terms of his thinking, but I think he's on the money when he says, you can't be a seriously well thought through, sort of highly educated person in the year of our Lord 2024 and still hold on to these fairy tales. What would you say to that person?
Well, if you're putting it precisely the way you did, I'd say it's interesting that we do still measure time in terms of the year of our Lord, AD, BC. There's something significant, you know, whether you believe it was a resurrection or not, something significant happens enough to completely shape the world that we find ourselves in now. So you, at that level alone, as a sort of interested skeptic, you've got to ask serious questions about just why did this bizarre little sect have this outsized impact on the rest of the world. But I want to say, you know, Richard Dawkins, as you just described there, has a worldview, but I don't think it's in any way justified by science. He has decided that at bottom there is nothing but blind, pitiless indifference, a universe with no design, no purpose, no good, no right. Well, I look at the universe and I see a very different universe to Richard Dawkins in that case. I see one where actually seems to be quite a lot of purpose. Seems to be some kind of design if you know, look at the best of what science tells us about it. Definitely seems to be a very real sense of right and wrong in most people's experience. And all of that has to be factored in to where you're willing to go. And if you keep pulling on that thread, I think you'll find at the end of it, there is something more than just molecules and the laws of nature going on here. Mm. But in all honesty, the best thing I could say to someone in that position is not just to kind of listen to endless debates with apologists about it. Go and read the Gospels and read the thing that completely changed the world 2,000 years ago and see whether, you know, you might just be able to find something in those Gospels that has continued to change people for generations and generations. And just honestly open up yourself to the idea that, you know, the most recent scientific explanations of reality are not necessarily the best explanations. There's this thing called chronological snobbery where we just assume whatever happens to be the latest explanation of something is the best that anyone's ever come up with.
Or the fullest, the sort of the scientific indeed. Answer that eliminates all other answers, which I think is often one people
exactly.
trip up.
And I just think, hopefully our you know, prospective skeptic that we've got in mind here might just have enough humility to say, okay, I'll give this a second look. So I would encourage them to go on that journey, keep pulling in that thread and not to simply assume the worldview that they've probably frankly imbibed just from being born in Western Europe in the 20th century.
Yeah. Or even in the wilds of America, where I live.
Yes, indeed.
and to add to Justin's helpful words there, if that is where you're sitting right now, thinking, do you know what? I kind of wish that I could believe this stuff, but like truly, I don't think that I can while holding on to my brain and my academic credentials, as it were. One of the things that I discovered over 9 years of talking with Christian professors at leading secular universities was that in every single field that is supposed to have disproved or discredited the Christian faith, there are very serious Christians who are world leaders in that field. And who, many of whom actually weren't necessarily even raised as Christians and are sort of continuing in their parental faith. Many, even at MIT down the street from where I live here, came to faith in Jesus later on, as you know, on as part of their intellectual journey, actually, and found faith in Jesus to be more satisfying as a way of understanding whether it was, you know, science or philosophy or psychology or history, whatever the discipline that they were engaged in. So don't believe the propaganda that says you cannot be a highly educated, highly intellectual man or woman and a serious follower of Jesus, because it's just not true.
Absolutely. And I've met more than enough examples to prove that to be the case.
Yeah.
In the end, it's not actually about science versus faith and that kind of thing, which is often painted as. It's two different worldviews. You know, there is a worldview called atheism. There's a worldview called Christianity. Both need to make their case. I've been on a sort of 20 odd year journey of hearing both sides, and I just find that on balance, Christianity is an incredibly compelling way of looking at the world that makes sense of far more data, I think, actually, than so you can take it in a logical direction and still come to a conclusion that actually all that exists is not matter. There's much more than that.
Well, thanks so much, Justin, for being with me today. As a reminder, if you want to check out Justin's recent book, The Surprising Rebirth of God, I recommend you do that. Or you can find Justin on sundry platforms, video, audio, etc. So many helpful conversations that he has instigated and chaired. So I recommend that you do that. You've been listening, for better or for worse, to the Confronting Christianity podcast. You can follow us on Instagram and, oh gosh, I really hate saying X, but I suppose it really is called X now. Artist formerly known as Twitter.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes. Which only because we're the age that we are, Justin, do we even get that reference. Most people aren't going to get it. Or you can leave a review on iTunes and note a question you'd like to see taken into consideration for future episodes. Next week, I'll be having another fascinating conversation with another follower of Jesus who's got some very interesting things to say. So join me then. Until then.